Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, it's a home improvement day on the show today, and we're going to be talking about some trends in remodeling and, of course, answering your questions about renovation and remodeling. And Chad Spates, the guy to do it, back with us, owner of Chad's Design Build. As we talk with him, of course, we want to hear from you. Maybe if you could change one thing in your home, what would it be? What about that? Maybe you have some need some help with a project, or maybe there's something that's bothering you about your home. You can give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Chad Spate, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure to be here.
You and I have been on the air for, I think, around 20 years now.
That is correct.
Let's talk about some of the early days of your career, because you go back before even 20 years.
You bet.
How'd you get started in all this?
Yeah, you know, you might say that I'm the accidental remodeler, because when I moved to Madison in 1992, I had been a high school history teacher down south of Dayton, Ohio, and I moved here to get a PhD, I thought, in history, and to become a history professor. And I had two marketable talents when I moved to Madison, because I did move here and apply once I had lived here a year. And I was either going to remodel homes, which had been a passion in my teenage years, working on the family home and doing theater set work, designing and building sets in high school theater, or I was going to be a substitute teacher while I was biding my time. And we had one friend in town who connected me to a one-person remodeling company. And I became his remodeler for 9 months, and he didn't have employees, so I established a company called Chad's Carpentry to be his one carpenter, and I would bill him. And anyway, that's how it started, and very soon, within a year, I was starting to solicit my own customers. I did enroll at UW in the sociology program. That unto itself is a long story that we won't go into, but it was great. I will say that I inadvertently connected my advisor in the sociology program. Her husband had reached out to me about a project, and when he handed me the check, this was back, you know, 3 years after I was in the program, I said, "Oh, you know, your wife, is she a sociology professor?" And it's like, "Yes, she is." I said, "Oh, she was my advisor." So, you know, there's been a lot of that small world stuff here in Madison. But, and I've, you know, before I came on this show, I had, and, you know, it was all serendipity, but I had back in the 90s done some renovation work for Jim Fleming, for example. Oh. Just, you know. Yeah. But it was a totally different path that brought me onto this show. But I found very quickly that I love remodeling homes, and I decided to put graduate school on hold. And it's ended. It's been a 30-year hold at this point. But I love what I do, and there's never a dull moment in the remodeling world. So.
It strikes me, your company name is Chad's Design Build.
Correct.
Let's talk about what a design build means and how it might be different from, you know, another approach to the same position.
Sure. So we formally changed our name in 2014, but the way we were doing business started to change around the time I came on your show about 20 years ago. The old model that a lot of people still expect when they call a remodeling contractor is that someone comes over to your home, they look at the project, they go away, and then at some point they may return or mail to you an estimate of the work that has been described. That's the old model. There's still people that operate that way, but for about 30 years now, the industry has been shifting somewhat. And every year there are more and more people that approach it a little differently. And design build is probably the dominant different model, whereby you interview contractors who are design build contractors. Most of the people that hire us have talked to other design build firms. You kind of talk about what you're hoping to do. And then you hire a company to do the planning, do the design, figure out what are the challenges, the pitfalls, the opportunities, and most importantly, to develop an accurate contract for what it is that is going to happen, what isn't going to happen, to provide that guidance and trusted consultation that really only someone who's charging for that service can reasonably provide. You know, the complaint that has dogged the remodeling industry for decades is that, well, I hired this contractor and, you know, he told me at the beginning it was going to be a $50,000 project and it suddenly became, you know, six figures and, you know, they couldn't do this and that, or it was very different than what I thought it was going to be, or, you know, they weren't very responsive to our questions, or, you know, it was long delayed, all these things that you hear. And what I realized, and then ultimately what we say to our prospective clients, is if you get a free estimate for something, what is that worth?
Yeah.
You know, it's worth what you paid for it, which is nothing. And that's the problem. And you figure if a contractor is giving these free quotes to, you know, multiple people every day, how much time do they reasonably have to figure out what they're getting into? And then what often happens is numerous change orders greet the client as the project unfolds. And it's not that there aren't changes on projects in any model. Of course, there can be changes. But we see our goal and our responsibility in the design build world is to do a much better job of not just, you know, helping the client make good decisions, but uncovering the sorts of surprises, which I'm putting here in air quotes for our listeners. You know, surprises really should, an experienced remodeler prepares their client for potential surprises. You know, because there are things that we know that we don't know before we tear a house apart.
Yeah.
And we do our best to figure those out. Sometimes we decide as part of that paid discovery and planning phase to open up some walls and to see what are we really, you know,
what's
going to
there?
Discover. But if we're not doing that, then, you know, we're preparing our clients for demolition day, where we're going to discover a lot of the things that we have not yet been able to absolutely confirm. And, you know, we're preparing them for those costs if we don't yet know.
But it's more you have the client then has a much more precise figure and idea about what this whole thing's going to be and
the
timing of it and everything else.
There's another aspect to this, too, that we often discuss with our prospective clients. If you go out and, you know, some people know that it's not good to just have the back of the napkin drawing and bring in the contractors to look at that and get estimates. And so they think, well, I'm going to hire a designer or an architect to create a plan. And there's nothing wrong with that approach, certainly. I mean, if they hire us, they're going to be getting designers and architects as part of the planning process.
Sure.
But the difference when you hire that individual on your own and then go out to solicit estimates is that every plan you get from an architect has it stamped on there that they're not responsible for the dimensions that are on that plan, that they have to be confirmed by the contractor. So it's always the contractor that is liable for all of this. And if your contractor is your designer, there's no passing the buck. Like that, you know, we are responsible for the totality of this project when you're working with a design build contractor. And that's a big, important advantage. And where it really comes into play is that a lot of times people will pay for a plan And then they'll find out from the contractors that visit that that project's going to cost 2 to 3 times what the architect or designer had told them it was likely to cost.
Oh.
And then you've paid for a plan that you can't afford to build.
Yeah.
And now what?
Yeah.
Do we go back to that designer to alter the plan or change the scope? You know, if we start working with someone, we're going to be talking about the budget, the comfort zone, what's really important to them. How do we provide as many of the amenities and improvements that they want to have for the price that they are able or comfortable investing in their home? You know, and so that's what guides it. Price and scope of work are never disconnected.
Well, that was a great explanation, Chad. Thank you for that. We have callers online with questions that relate to their own homes.
Great.
And we'll give folks a chance to join in. You can join in. We still have an open line at 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. Christina in Glenwood City has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We are having the entire house painted with some drywall repair, including pulling carpets and replacing with some kind of laminate flooring. And so my question is, the painter said that we should clean the ductwork before the project begins, but the owner of the duct company said we should clean them afterwards. Because you're going to be getting drywall dust, et cetera. So what are your thoughts? Do you clean before or after a project?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Christina. That's a great one. I can understand why a painting contractor would certainly want to have clean ducts. And if the duct works really do need to, if that does need to be cleaned, then the appropriate time would be once you're ready for the paint to be applied to the walls. Because at that point, pretty much all of the demolition has happened, the drywall, the sanding. That, you know, drywall finishing and sanding is one of the most dust-intensive parts of any renovation. And a lot can be done to collect that dust and mitigate. And certainly you shouldn't be allowing that dust to get sucked into your central HVAC system. And it's also true that dust in the return ducts is not likely to be redistributed through your home if you have a proper filter installed in your furnace system and that filter is regularly replaced or cleaned, but that would be the appropriate time to do the cleaning once the dust has been created with the drywall and then prior to the painting.
Christina, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at home renovation and repair on the show today with our guest, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. Again, questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Diane in Rhinelander. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Chad. Hi, Larry. I have a log home. And this year, we have noticed that we have carpenter ants, and we're kind of panicking. We have set out all kinds of traps and things, and one log is definitely soft, and it's a bottom log above the deck. Is there anything we as homeowners can do to deal with the damage without, I don't know, some kind of crazy something? what are your suggestions?
Yeah, Diane, thanks for the call. Well, that is, on the one hand, it's a challenging problem, but I suspect that the reason that the log beneath the deck has become compromised and thus then infested with the carpenter ants, which tend to like wood that has suffered some sort of water damage. They don't tend to...
They don't start the damage.
Right, that's right. They come and they digest the damaged wood, cellulose fiber. So the trick is going to be two things. One is to do some flashing work where that deck is attached to the home so that the water is not getting into the wall and into the log there. And I suspect the way the board is attached to the home where the deck is attached, perhaps some things weren't quite done right there, or maybe they were done properly and it's just that a lot of water is getting in there, you know, and the points of connection where the bolts or the lag screws are going into the house, water is penetrating at that point. And so some flashing is going to have to be done to prevent that from happening in the future. And then the log itself, which is soft, probably is going to need to be repaired or replaced in some manner. Because over time, I mean, right now, inertia is probably keeping things in the right place. But as that damaged material continues to, you know, lose its ability to hold the load that it once held, then you could end up seeing some compression and some structural distortion that you don't want to have. So you probably will need someone who's, you know, a qualified contractor to address that structural repair. And a log home is, you know, very much a specialty thing. I mean, it's not something that my company would touch because we don't build, and I've never had the opportunity to renovate a log home. And I would, you know, I'd be very curious, but to learn about it. But it's something different.
So in Rhinelander area, there should be people with expertise with log homes.
Absolutely.
In that area.
I mean, there are builders around. I mean, there are people that do this around the state of Wisconsin. And I would, I don't know how old, Diane, your home is. I don't know if it's possible to reach out to the original builder. But I would look into finding a well-regarded log home builder to see if they can't assist with that repair.
There you go, Diane. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it, and good luck. Appreciate your call. Dave in Appleton will go to you. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So just a quick question on the venting system question that you had before, cleaning the venting. What does it really matter if you clean the vents from the house to the filter, since the filter is going to clean everything out, and eventually, if there's a lot of loose dust and debris in there, eventually you change the filter enough, that part, that section between your home and the filter, what does it matter if that's cleaned or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dave, thank you for that question. I mean, that was, you're making the point that I was attempting to make earlier, that I have mixed feelings about duct cleaning, because it is true that everything that's on the return side of an HVAC system where you've got air recirculating in a home is going to go through that filter prior to the air going through the fan and being redistributed in the home. So that's why you change those filters regularly, so that, you know, because a dirty filter does not have good airflow. As more and more dirt is trapped in the filter, which is supposed to happen, less and less air goes through the filter. And so you have to change or clean a filter regularly so that it is able to actually function and continue to collect and trap the dust. But when you have renovation work, and let's say there's been renovation work that has not been done with care to prevent dust from getting sucked into that system because you really don't want a bunch of dust to be in the system. Because then the potential for it to get disturbed and then redistributed is always there. If you know that your ducts are really dirty, there might be some value in having them cleaned from time to time. But certainly if the supply side of your system has gotten dirty, then that is a concern. There's no way to address that without cleaning it once you're on the supply side of the fan.
Thinking about my own situation with my filters, I have filters in the basement. I usually get a year's supply at once, and I also have a little pad of paper with the last, and every time I put a new filter in, I note the date.
Oh, yeah.
And then I try to, you know, then when I go downstairs, I can see that, okay, you did this 5 weeks ago.
Right.
Whatever. And so I'm hoping that helps.
Yeah, we typically keep a Sharpie right by the furnace, and you know we put the date on the filter, whether it's a furnace filter or a water filter in the refrigerator, whatever the case may be. I find labeling the filter for me is the trick that allows me to confirm that I'm on schedule. So,
Dave, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Deb in Wausau has a question. Hi, Deb.
Hi, this is Deb Butke, and I'm wondering, do you normally, I just had a bunch of remodeling done, and my contractor billed me for 8 hours a day, even though he only worked six or less for three people, and I wondered if that was a fair practice, or is that usually what happens? He says he bills for half an hour going to the place, half an hour going home, and lunch a half an hour. But where I live, you can't go to lunch for a half an hour. So it's anywhere from an hour to hour and a half. So on the average, they work 5.5 to 6 hours, but I got billed for 8. What do you think?
Well, Deb, thanks for the question. There are two things here to talk about. I mean, one is what your contract was and how the contractor is charging you. And it sounds like maybe you had what I'll call a time and materials contract where you're being billed for however much time it takes, and you're not going to know what that total cost is until the project is done. There are many reasons why we avoid that sort of a contractual relationship with our client, because it's so difficult to not have any certainty as to what we're all getting into. It's often great for the contractor, except that often the bill then gets disputed by the homeowner. And so then it creates another headache there. And sometimes everyone can end up unhappy. So I'm not sure what your contract was and how it relates to that, but I will say that as someone that doesn't tend to do that, but we do plan for what it's going to cost to do your job, and we have an expectation that we might have, 300 hours on a project, and that's part of that contract we have. We are certainly going to be billing for the time that we are spending working on your job, and not all of that work happens at your home. There is sometimes shop work that happens. Sometimes we have to acquire materials directly or move materials from a warehouse to the job site. I mean, this is all part of the cost of doing the job. And so what I suspect is partly going on here is that that's how this contractor is accounting for their time. But I would expect that to be spelled out in a contract. From our perspective, a good contract tells you exactly what you are going to be getting. It's going to point out some things that are not going to be provided, or maybe sometimes the homeowner is providing a fixture or a cabinet or something like that, in which case that should be specified in the contract. To the extent that there is labor that is billed out by the hour, the contract should specify, you know, whether it includes things like trip charges and lunch breaks and things like that. That should be a part of it.
Yeah, you should go back and take a look at that contract, Deb, for sure. And that's the explanation. Thank you very much for calling. Do you have a home remodeling repair question for our guest today, Chad Spade? I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And if you phone, we'll get you on pretty quickly here. Dan emailed us. He's having a dickens of a time removing the fiber rock under the laminate, I think, that is nailed and glued to the subfloor, and wonders what's the best way to remove that fiber rock.
Yeah, so, well, the first thing that we have to talk about is, has the material that Dan is removing, has that been tested for asbestos or any other possible contaminant? Because whenever we are removing material like that, we have to have it tested, because we are exposing not just our work crew, but a homeowner potentially to, you know, a very harmful contaminant. Lead and asbestos are the two primary contaminants that we are very attentive to in the remodeling trades. And so that material is going to have to be tested. If I think I know, you know, fiber rock could be a few different materials, but if it is kind of a typical concrete board or fiber like soundboard, I mean, often those are sheet goods that are glued down, and that's probably
nailed and glued.
You're right. So, you know, that it, removing the fasteners is not enough, and it's going to have to be scraped out. Oftentimes, like a mechanical scraper might be the right tool for that. And again, if it's not a hazardous material, then there are tools like that that can be used. Sometimes we take an appropriate saw and cut it up into pieces so that it can be removed in controlled quantities, you know, so you're not trying to pry up massive sheets of something, particularly if for whatever reason it's not coming apart. But again, once we know that contamination is not a threat, that would be what we might suggest.
Let's take a call from Rita in Green Bay. Hi, Rita.
Hello. I'm very interested in what you're talking about. How do I find a guy like Chad in the Green Bay area?
How do you find a contractor?
I'm sure they exist. And so the place that I always like to recommend, as I've been a member of the National Association of the Remodeling Industry for 26 years now, and I know there is a chapter up in the Fox Valley, I would recommend that you look to the NARE chapter there in the Fox Valley and see who are the contractors that participate in that association. The reason that I've always been passionate about the association is that there is a code of ethics to which we all have to adhere, which has to do with, you know, avoiding unscrupulous marketing and sales tactics, as well as having legal contracts and basically keeping our word and living up to the contracts that we have signed with our clients. And if you've, you know, had a bad experience, homeowners file complaints with the association. And so it really does help you know, have a higher bar of you know, ethics within our group. And the other thing is client education, which we're passionate about, making sure that clients know how to go about hiring someone. So, you know, it's Also looking online, looking at reviews. And I would, you know, say that there are many, many different sites where people can submit reviews. You know, obviously reviews are something that you have to look at with a critical eye. You know, some people seem to find out a way to quash bad reviews. Mm. You know, I mean, we have a few bad reviews when you go looking for us. There aren't many, but the negative reviews, I'd say half of them are people that never hired us. There was something they didn't like about the communication. You know, you're looking at what people have to say, and then often you're seeing what the contractor may have said in response. You can search for things like design build contractor. Let's say if you're looking to remodel your kitchen or bathroom or whatever it is, a well thought out search on your computer will probably render some pretty good results. At least it'll capture the people that you want to get to know and you want to talk to. And of course, it'll capture other people that maybe have just paid to be put in front of you when you search for those keywords. But
if you go, though, to NARI, the National Association of Home Remodeling,
the remodeling industry,
home remodeling industry. That's NAHRI.
NARI.
Sorry.
The National Association of the Remodeling Industry.
Okay, so it's NARI. So, if you go to that association, you'll see members in your area.
Correct.
Then you can go. All right, let's pick from those, and then follow through with some of your other suggestions.
Yeah, if you go to the national site, which is nari.org, you will then be able to put in a search for either a chapter in your area, where then it might direct you to the website of the local chapter, or it will, because we all, if we're in a local chapter, or we're a member at large, which is to say we don't have a local chapter, but we are a member of the larger national association, all of us are in the national website database. And so you can search at that database for your area, and you're likely to find some people that match your criteria. Also, there's the Better Business Bureau that again is something that you choose to participate in, they rate people and they track data on whether or not someone is in good standing. So
there you go, Reed. Thank you. Good luck with your search. Appreciate it very much. Your
yes.
comments and questions.
Good
today.
Luck,
Danny and Marinette. We'll go to you now. Hi, Danny.
Hello. Got a question. I got a house that was built in the 60s, and it was built in wetlands with a cinder block basement, concrete floor. The house is constantly shifting, and those cinder blocks keep cracking. Is there any way to kind of stable that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, you've kind of set up a scenario where, you know, you've explained that it was a challenging site to perhaps build a home on, and then a cinder block foundation is a uniquely porous foundation that has many points that water can find its way through, and often it can collect in that cavity that is many times left as a cavity when the wall is assembled. And so they tend to be very wet, and if you don't have good solid ground underneath the footings, presuming that the house had footings put under those cinder block walls, you know, if they are in fact shifting and moving, that's challenging. So you're going to have two options. One is to try to reinforce this. There are companies that specialize in installing kind of structural strapping on the inside of that cinder block wall that will help to add additional structural integrity to those cinder blocks to help stabilize them. Sometimes it's a matter of trying to deal with places where the wall is
bulging out, or
that's
bulging
right,
in
yeah, bulging or... in, or possibly out. I mean, you're wanting to stabilize it. Sometimes you're wanting to do a little corrective action. It could be that the footings, as I had alluded to, might need some enhancement done. There might need to be something done on the inside of that wall to improve the footing and allow kind of an interior structural skeleton to be erected to help address these deficiencies. But there are people that specialize in that particular type of work. And I would recommend that you reach out to some of those folks. You may end up wanting to hire an engineer who can help create a clear plan as well for what needs to happen.
Yeah, I had a circumstance with that with not my own home, but with a relative's home. And I brought in one of the guys, and he, one of the people who do that belting and so forth. And he said, you know, I'm pretty sure I know exactly what to do, but I work with a structural engineer, and I'd really like to have him look at it.
Right.
And so the structural engineer came in and essentially said what the guy had thought it would be the case, but right. He wanted to be absolutely sure. So a little extra money there, but in the end, all well worth the cost.
Absolutely. And that's a process we go through with our own clients when we're addressing concerns like this. I mean, we bring in a structural engineer to be a part of the team. To make sure that the plan is a good one.
Yeah. So. Danny, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Chad Spade, our guest today, owner of Chad's Design Build of Madison and Monona. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News, taking a look at home renovation and repair with our guest today, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. You can join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Tom in Madison next. Hi, Tom.
Hey there. I think it's ironic that the woman that just had questions about foundation is very similar to mine. I have the same situation, you know, cracks in the foundation, and but not maybe that bad that I'm all concerned about. My concern is putting an addition on. And, again, maybe I need to look at engineers. I know there's screws that can be put in the ground. And I didn't know if there's things that you can bring in soil to beef up the existing soil. But, yeah, very similar situation. Just wondering about the foundation and what I need to look at.
So, and it's a deck, or is it a room, or what is it that you're adding?
I think it would be a room about 30 by 20.
Okay.
Okay. And so the current foundation to your home, is it a cinder block, I take it?
It is a cinder block with basement and a very old home. I guess it was brought in and placed here on, and, you know, existing soil is like maybe 12 inches of topsoil, then about 6 feet of beach sand that I think was deposited here, and then that below that, solid peat.
Okay. Okay. Well, so, you know, with any structure, the soil conditions are an important consideration when putting in a foundation. And, you know, sometimes the soil conditions are such that really you have to go deeper with a foundation, and it could be that the soil conditions, it sounds like, you know, might require some additional support beyond the typical way that we would build. I mean, often we're always looking to get down to undisturbed soil, and then that soil has to have a certain compression capacity. And these are things that, you know, can be measured. And some coring can be done in the area where you're planning to put the addition, knowing that you have these concerns, to determine if there might be some additional things that could be done with the addition or with your existing home, just to make it so that you're not going to have problems and concerns.
Tom, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Peter in Appleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Larry and Chad. So I have a 1950s story and a half small home that has a bit of permastone on the outside that was popular at the time. And through some settlement over the years, there are some hairline cracks and a bit of spalling on it. And so my question is it really practical, or what methods could a homeowner take on to repair it? Or if going the contractor route, I think as you just touched on, sometimes reviews or references can be a little nebulous. Are there any pointed questions or topics to discuss with a contractor to assess their capabilities for a repair?
Sure. Thanks for the call, Peter. So there are a couple of things. I mean, you know, you're probably going to be talking to masons to do this work, certainly. And so, as is the case with almost any project, what I want to know, and I would encourage you and our listeners, you know, what experience do they have with similar projects? I mean, that the best case scenario is to find someone who has dealt with this a number of times and has confidence in their ability to improve your stonework on your home. So you're probably going to spend some time searching around for the right contractor, and but I'd be looking for that first and foremost. And then once you found some people that have that experience and are willing to come out and talk to you about the project, you know, that's when you're looking more carefully at what their reputation is, what your comfort level is with the contractor. You know, do you feel like they're doing a good job of communicating with you and asking good questions of you? You know, those are the sorts of things that I would recommend. I mean, and it's challenging. I mean, I can tell you as an established contractor, when we're going out looking to have a mason or an electrician or whatever the case may be, you know, as a trusted part of our team, you know, it is hard to find good people to work with and to, and don't get me wrong, I mean, there are many people out there, but it's hard to find them, and it's hard to then become someone that, you know, you can partner with, because the good folks are busy and, you know.
Yeah.
But hopefully that helps.
Yeah. Peter, good luck with that. Thank you very much for calling. Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I just got a quick question for you. It's actually more of a your opinion. Before you bought our house, the foundation was bowing. So one of the things in the contract was that they fixed the foundation before we actually bought the house, closed on the house, which is fine. They did a good job. But my question for you is, we're not in a flood zone and we're nowhere near water or anything. Mm-hmm. And they put a second sump pump in when they fixed the bowing walls. I was wondering what your hypothesis is why they did that.
Great question. So having a second sump pump is actually just a good practice for redundancy, because when a pump fails, if you only have one pump, then, you know, the water is not going to be taken away from the foundation and pumped out. So, I mean, the most benign explanation is that they were engaging in good you know,
a belt and suspenders.
Yes,
approach.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, you know, could it be that occasionally the amount of water that was coming in was overwhelming the existing pump, and therefore they thought that, well, this was an obvious solution to that? I mean, again, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. You could have put in a larger pump or put in a second pump. And then, you know, I'd argue that having redundancy is better than relying on one larger pump. You know, sometimes it's great to have a pump that's on a battery backup, because often when the bad storm hits and your pump is struggling to keep up, that's when we lose power. And so there are a variety of good reasons that you would have a second pump and potentially a pump on a battery. So
there you go, Nick. Thank you very much for calling. Michael in Middleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Oh, hi. This is an unsolicited testimonial, disclaimer.
about, I don't know how many years ago, I called into a show like this to talk to Chad about siding. I had pages of notes, and they did a great job. So that's it. I'm done.
Thank you.
We just had our roof replaced like last week, and now it's like my dream has always been solar panels, and I'm just wondering if Chad has any ideas about that.
So, Michael, thanks for the call and the kind words. So solar panels certainly are a good thing to consider when you have a newer roof, and it sounds like you have the newer roof. Now, to put solar panels on a home, there are a couple of things that are going to need to be true about your home. I mean, one is that you're going to need to have good sun exposure, and that's something that solar contractors will look at with you. And I presume that if you're looking to put it on the roof, you already know that you have a mostly south-facing roof that is not obstructed by shade. But that will be looked at. And then the other important thing that will have to be considered is the structural capacity of the roof itself the roof structure. You know, the rafters, the ridge beam, or as is often the case with an older home, ridge boards, maybe it's a truss system, however your roof is constructed. That structure needs to accommodate a little bit more load with the solar panels on it. And so that, too, is something that a qualified solar installer would be able to help you with. And I'd be remiss if I didn't also mention that, and perhaps you know this, Michael, I mean, time is of the essence. I mean, there is still a federal tax credit rebate that we are eligible to claim for, and I don't want to say that I'm absolutely 100% clear, but from things that I've read on the recent tax legislation, I think any system that's installed and to completion in 2025 will still qualify for that 30% tax credit, and then there will be no incentive on January 1st of 2026. So
you need to move fairly
quickly.
Yeah,
I'm not sure how easy it will be to find someone to do that, but as we are in the latter half of the year, but maybe you will be able to meet that deadline. And either way, you'll need to make sure that it's a good location and that your structure is up to the task.
Good luck, Michael. Thank you. Cheryl, do you have a quick question for us? Hi, Cheryl.
Real quick. Hi. So I have a very large cinder block outbuilding, two stories. It's about five bays, garage bays. We are considering, it's about 60 years old. We are considering making the upper level into a livable space. And I first want to get an assessment from some structural engineer or someone that knows concrete to see if that's something we could do and if it makes sense to do. So I'm just asking for a recommendation of how would I find that kind of person.
So that would be, looking at, searching for those services, essentially, for structural engineer for a residential cinder block building. I mean, there are many people out there that have this skill and will be able to potentially help you with that. I'm not sure of a particularly good source to recommend as far as a website or a membership, but maybe offline we'd be able to get something to you.
Yeah, or the person who's going to be doing the remodeling of the house might have a recommendation of a structural engineer too, if you have that person already, him or her already picked.
It's definitely an important part of the planning for this project. And then zoning will be another thing to consider if you haven't already.
Yeah. Cheryl, things to think about. Thank you for calling. Chad Spade will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll be talking with him in just a few minutes. I'm Larry Mueller.
Great to have you with us for WPR News. It's a home improvement day with our guest, Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build. And there's still time for your home improvement questions. Let us know what changes you're thinking about making in your home this spring. Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Andy in Madison called. We couldn't stay with us. He says he thinks there's three different types of contracts: design build, design bid build, and time and materials as the third. What's your comment to that, Chad?
Yeah, well, so it is important to note that in the world of construction contracts, whether we're just talking about design build or whether we're talking about someone who comes out and gives you a free estimate, and then they do that becomes kind of the contract. That is not necessarily a time and materials contract, unless that's how the contract is structured. And design build firms have different ways of taking you through the design and planning phase and then moving into the build contractual phase. So it's complicated, and we all try to make it less complicated by clearly explaining what our process is, but every company has its own way of doing this, and that's the challenge for consumers. And I can't just wave a wand and make that become more standardized. But for those of us that are in design build, I mean, we advocate for a basic process, which tends to be you sign up first for that design and development. We have a conceptual phase as step one. Then if the client is happy with the concept that we settle on and the basic budget, we move into step two of development, which is called finalization for my company. Other mm-hmm. companies have a different way or might have a different way of describing it. The third step for us is the contract, which is the final cost, which, of course, has been bid. I mean, we go out to bid to our suppliers, to our trade partners. Often we are looking for, second or third opinion on some aspect of the project. If a price comes back from our trusted electrician and we think, this seems a little high, we're going to check it. It's all unique to a job and unique to a company.
Jeffrey emailed us, what's the typical markup or profit margin on remodeling contracts?
Yeah, so that is a great question. And I mean, the simple answer is that it's all over the map. I will say that new homes are typically a much lower markup than remodeling. And the biggest reason for that is that there's a lot less risk in a new home because there isn't someone living in the thing that's being manufactured and produced. And so it's also true that a given room in a new home is less expensive to build than if you come back later and add that room onto an existing home, because every system in the home and the structure itself have to be altered to accommodate the new addition. But remodeling, in my experience, the typical desired net profit at the end of a project in our industry, the standard expectation is that the contractor will end up with about a 10% net profit. That is the goal. A healthy remodeling company will achieve that mark. I mean, again, it's a goal. What happens often is, it's been very rare in our history that we've achieved that goal. Maybe once or twice in 30 years, we get close to it. But obviously, that's not a lot of wiggle room there. If everything goes as planned, then, you know, 10 cents out of every dollar will be will have paid for the project that was produced and the, you know, the operating expenses of the business, and you hope for that 10% net profit.
Yeah, but it could turn into 8 or 9%.
Oh, well, yeah, or negative 4 or whatever the case may be. I mean, you know, there are good years and bad, and there are projects sometimes that, I mean, you know, from there again, it's all the philosophy of the company, and you know, we are and many great contractors out there and home builders, you know, they're looking to have a happy client and to do repeat business with folks and establish that relationship. And so that's where, you know, you take a hit because that's, you know, you're ethical, you're honest, you're like, look, you know, we screwed up or this didn't go as planned. And, you know, that's our problem, not your problem. And so that money you lost is a marketing expense in your integrity and your reputation. And that's how we look at it.
Have there been a, I'm thinking about technology and technology changes. How has technology changed jobs like home remodeling in general?
So that's a great question. I would say the biggest impact that we have seen is in the customer experience and project management of construction. The smartphones, the computer that we all have in our pocket, or the tablets that we'll have at a job site, all of the information about a project is there. And a lot of that information, in our case and many other companies that you'd work with, will be shared on some software platform with the customer. So the customer can log on and see, what is my contract? What is my schedule? What is the total cost of this project? When is my next payment due? What have I paid to date? What were my selections? What's my to-do list? I mean, all this stuff. You know, yeah. We're using it from the beginning of planning all the way through to the contract being finalized and then ultimately the production of that renovation or addition. And that technology has helped to share good information with our team and with the homeowner. Of course, there have been advances in some of the materials that we use, you know, in technology with respect to heating systems and monitoring humidity and temperature, better zoning systems. The ductless systems that have become dominant, which really help with renovation, you know, where it was often really hard to connect the addition or the new space to the existing centralized HVAC system. And now it's much easier to just have a ductless supplemental system for the addition or to address a part of a home that's far away from the central system and it just needs to have its own system. The ductless systems are the perfect kind of mini system. You know, that mini split is a great mini furnace, mini air conditioner, whatever you may say.
I look at, you know, you go to somebody's home and they have maybe done some work that I personally probably, I might not have done myself because of the style. Are there trends that I'm wondering that people 10 years after they did it could say, oh, man, why did we do that?
Sure. Well, you know, so one of the things that comes up that I'd be remiss not to mention, I mean, like, you know, lighting is a technology, right? We've seen just an explosion of innovation with LED lighting in the last 10 years. And of course, some people who were early adopters to that might regret it because the lighting is a lot cooler, a lot bluer than what they would like to have. They miss that warmth of the, you know, the xenon or halogen bulbs that they replaced. Now, of course, we can provide that with an LED. You can have light fixtures and light bulbs that are connected to your smartphone, and you can change the warmth of the bulb on any given day. You know, these, so a lot of the technology has actually given, made it easier for people to change their mind after it's installed. Yeah, there are things that come along that maybe haven't been well tested that people end up maybe regretting. I try not to be an early adopter for that reason and not to promote products that are, you know, have only been out for 5 years.
So. I'm thinking about my own home. There's some wiring that I put in, for example, to have outdoor speakers.
Sure.
From 14 years ago, maybe. And of course, there's no use for those.
Right.
Because you just bring your speaker out and set it up, and it's running my Wi-Fi or something.
Sure. Yeah. So much is cordless now, and even switches and things like that. I mean, we can add a third or fourth switch to a given circuit. And it's Wi-Fi connected to the main switch or the original switch. And you don't even have to run the wires. So, you know, but then if the Wi-Fi is not working, yeah. The switch doesn't work. So
yeah. There you go. Rose in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rose.
Is there anything you can tell me about window trim when installing new windows in cedar siding?
So could you possibly provide a little more information there? I mean, so are you having new windows installed? Are you replacing trim that has been damaged? Are you hoping to change the aesthetic of your home?
We're replacing old windows with new windows. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is the trim will keep it all sealed and safe. But it's that deep ridges of the wide cedar planks that I'm wondering if you have any do's or don'ts for us.
Hmm. Okay, so great question. So the first thing that I would just point out is that the trims on a home, similar to whatever the siding on the home, whether you have cedar siding, but you might have masonry or you might have vinyl siding or whatever the case may be, all of those exterior skins protect the flashing underneath it. And really what keeps water out of a house is everything that's behind the trim and the siding. Or, you know, the masonry is a form of siding.
Sure.
And so it's important that all of the flashing and the waterproofing that's behind these things is done properly before that final layer is put up to protect that flashing and waterproofing. And so then there's the material itself, which is exposed. And if you're going to put up a traditional cedar siding, which is a great material to use for an exterior trim or siding, it's also one of the more expensive materials to use. And it is a high maintenance material. It does require ongoing upkeep. So whether it's going to be painted or stained, it can be used. The downside to large boards that are, say, over 4 inches wide, that's going to have to be a high grade, a more expensive grade of cedar to avoid the cupping and cracking, other things that you might see if a less expensive grade of cedar would be installed. I'm not sure if I'm addressing
your
question.
Yeah, I think so. I just want to make sure it's all sealed up is the main thing.
Yeah, and as you're saying, it's the under that...
Yeah, the underside's the most important, but then the material itself, which will protect that underside for for the integrity of the home, then that material, to be effective and to look nice, is going to have to be properly stained or painted and then kept up.
Yeah.
And of course, there are appropriate places to potentially caulk or not caulk, again, because water always has to stay outside of the home. And there are places where on any home, any building, water is designed to be essentially kind of shunted out to the exterior, whether it's little weep holes or different spots right above where the drip cap is. You know, if you caulk above a drip cap, then you're trapping the water that is coming down and is supposed to get diverted out of the structure at that point, for example. So
yeah, there you go. Rose, thank you. Jerry in Kakana has, I think, a window replacement question as well. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, thanks, Larry and Chad. My question is twofold. First of all, the best material that windows should be made out of, and is there a second choice down the line? I imagine it's going to be fiberglass. And the second part of that question is, if I have aluminum-sided house, is there a way that I can have the window installed that I don't have to do any trim painting or anything? Is there a way to get around that?
Okay. Yeah, great question. So windows first, best material. I am a big fan of fiberglass as the modern best material for windows and doors. Exterior windows and exterior doors. Certainly, I would say the runner-up to that is typically an old-fashioned wood window or door, which has had a either an aluminum or fiberglass skin on the exterior, which is going to then protect that material and give you a durable exterior surface. I am not a fan of vinyl. Vinyl has become the dominant material for windows. It has become certainly the dominant siding material. It's inexpensive and thus arguably more affordable, but I view affordability as like total cost of ownership. There are external costs associated with materials, and you know, vinyl, very polluting to produce it. And once it gets broken, you really can't repair it. You know, fiberglass and wood can be repaired without being completely removed and then replaced. So that's kind of my big picture advice on that topic. And then as far as aluminum siding, a lot of times when you're replacing a window, the aluminum siding, depending on what the trim on the old window was, if there wasn't much of a trim there, the siding has to be cut back so that the new window can be properly integrated with the waterproofing of the structure. And then a trim is installed around it. And, you know, that trim can be a variety of materials, but there are some kind of modern, of course, one option is a vinyl or a plastic trim, which again, I have my, reservations about that material, but there are materials that are composite that have been engineered to resist all of the things that just a wood material would do. It's not going to warp or crack. It's going to hold paint much better because it's stable. It's not likely to rot or be diminished by pests. There are a variety of products out on the market that meet that criteria. So that's typically what we're using for an exterior trim, and some of those products come in a variety of architectural styles that allow us to match older homes. So hopefully that helps.
Yeah, Jerry, thank you for calling. And Cindy from Janesville emailed. She has a simple 500-square-foot flat deck with 12 inches, about 12 inches off the ground, no railings, that has to be replaced due to warping and likely an understructure brace repair, she says. I'm not sure. Quotes that she got, three quotes, $60,000, $30,000, $7,800. From three different contractors, she can understand some percentage of differences due to materials, but this type of difference in quotes seems out of bounds. They were looking at 30 years plus warranty on the deck. Thoughts on a reasonable range for a deck replacement of that size, 500 square feet?
500 square feet. Yeah, well, so, I mean, I don't, like it. I think you can disqualify the low one just outright because I don't know how you'd even supply good materials for anywhere close to that cost. And typically when you have different pricing like this, it's simply that you're getting something very different for it. You know, what is being kept and what is being replaced? You know, one of these contractors may be thinking they're reusing footings or reusing the framework of the existing deck with just a few minor modifications and then putting a new skin on it. You know, sometimes there are materials that you can install over old decking to kind of give it a new skin, but you're not actually replacing the deck. And maybe that's what one of the lower cost proposals is. And then you could have two contracts that are giving you the same actual deck and materials, but they're not providing the same level of planning, communication, quality control, all these things. So you might have a really bad experience, which, you know, that's how you're paying for it. You know, it's like a bad experience that takes a year to complete. So,
yeah, it involves, I would say, talking to the two contractors and the $60,000. What am I getting for this? And then what am I getting for the $30,000? And in great detail.
And the contract really should spell out a lot of those details, and then you're going to have to fill in the blanks based on research, talking to other clients of those contractors, looking at reviews. And figuring out, like, you know, is it worth it to maybe hire that, you know, $60,000 contractor? Maybe you really are getting what you want with that contractor.
Yeah.
You'll have to decide. Good luck.
Good luck. And, Chad, good luck and thank you.
Thanks,
so
Larry.
Thanks for coming by. I appreciate it very much. You'll be back in a couple of months and we'll do it all again.
Sounds good.
Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, our guest today. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention Chad's Design Build is one of WPR's many business sponsors. We certainly appreciate that as well. Well, we've been talking renovation, repair. We're going to take a look at your roof now. Coming up next, we'll talk about care of your home's roof during the summer. I'm Larry Mealer. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're going to take a look at your home's roof right now. It's a nice feeling to have a good roof over your head, but certainly like other areas of your home, your roof needs regular maintenance to stay in good condition. And we're going to talk about summertime roof care now with Josiah Perkins with us. He's a senior residential sales manager at Security Libkey Roofing in Appleton, Wisconsin. We'll talk with Josiah about common summer roofing issues in the Midwest, how attic ventilation affects roof health, and maybe which DIY, do-it-yourself mistakes you want to avoid or try to avoid, and a whole lot more, of course. And we want to hear from you. Give us your questions about taking care of cleaning your roof or a roof repair at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Josiah, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
I went online to your site. You guys have been around a long time. Tell us about Security Libkey Roofing.
Well, we have been around a long time. It's gone through a number of different transformations, but we think all of those for the better. Learned a lot of things throughout the years as far as what to do, what not to do, what works, and what doesn't work, with a pretty solid growing team that have been with us for a good while as well.
Yeah, and I think the company itself, 90 years, something like that. That's amazing. What tell us about what you do for Security Libkey.
Well, I primarily oversee all the estimators and then the customer care team that's here in the office. So they take the incoming calls, but they also are responsible for keeping customers up to date on how their project is coming along in terms of when it's scheduled and how progress is going. We just want to keep everybody as informed as possible as the projects are proceeding.
We kind of forget about the roof a little bit, unless the leaks start to develop. But it requires some maintenance, does it not, from time to time, the roof?
It requires some attention. Maintenance, I guess, depends on the type of roof and where you're located and kind of what your roof has to primarily deal against. So if you have a lot of trees covering your roof or shading your house, the attention to detail there is going to be different than if you're out in the open where the sun's just beating down on it all day long.
Yeah.
So
Jeff in Pelican Lake has a question for you already, so let's go there. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My problem is I have a metal roof. It's about 20 years old. It was green. It was a nice green. And now, because of all the trees, the sap, the dust, and then this last fault with the ashes from Canada, that green roof, it looks really bad. How do you clean it?
How do you clean a metal roof?
Yeah, that's a pretty good question. So I'm assuming it's a smooth metal, so it's kind of like a painted steel that you've got on?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, I'm guessing what's going on is there's just a bit of fading that's happening with the metal, and after 20 years, just depending, especially with the progress of the quality of paints that have happened, whether that be internal or external paints, really. But speaking 20 years ago, obviously the technology was a little bit different in developing the paint, so there's some fading going on. So to get the true color back, it's outside of hiring a painter to repaint it, which I'm not a painter, so I can't speak to what that process would look like specifically. But cleaning it should be relatively simple. For the most part, it can be as simple as spraying it off, maybe a soft bristle broom if somebody's up for going on the roof, but that would definitely be something to seriously consider in terms of a safety aspect. But it doesn't have to take a lot of effort necessarily with say like a gentle setting on a power washer, to just kind of gently spray some of the stuff off that's up there.
Yeah. So it should be, it'd be hard on my roof because I've got a 3-story house, but so
yeah, that would be.
That's those are the kind where you have to get a piece of equipment in to lift the person up on some sort of contraption that's kind of expensive just to run to even use a hose.
Yeah, and the danger, I should reiterate the safety concerns in that, because as soon as one of those metal roofs is wet, it becomes extremely slippery. So it can be very precarious if you're trying to stand on the roof. So, yes, a basket of some sort is the best bet. The good news is, like, dirt and debris on a metal roof is not going to deteriorate the material itself. So functionally, it should still keep going.
Yeah, that's the those are the things to think about, Jeff. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck with the cleaning. Let's turn our attention to Patty in Green Bay next. Hi, Patty.
Hello. Thank you for this show. Just in the perfect time for me to ask this question. I have an asphalt shingle roof on my garage, and it is covered with moss or algae. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of what you were just talking about before. But the large shade tree does not allow, you know, to get any sun to dry it. And it's getting to be very serious. So I feel like I want to have it cleaned rather than replaced, if possible. And there is products on the market that are called no bleach. They have no bleach in, and they're supposed to be just put on with, you hook it onto your hose and just spray it on and then brush it off. Is this something that would hurt my shingles to use that particular product, do you think?
Patty, to add a little bit, do you know how old the shingles are? How long have...
I do not know. I am sorry. I just recently acquired this condo, and I do not know how old the roof is. But they said it was in satisfactory condition when we had it evaluated.
Okay.
So I'm not sure.
Okay. So Josiah, what do you think?
Yeah, those are great questions. We see that a lot when we're inspecting roofs in terms of the different types of growth. There's different varieties. So, and you'd mentioned two of them, the moss and the algae. Whereas moss is like an actual little plant, like a little green spongy type looking organism that can grow on the roof in very specific conditions. Whereas algae is looking like what it looks like is a bunch of black streaks on the roof, which is pretty common. Now if it's the moss that we're talking about, we want to be a little bit careful with that, because what's happening with the moss is it's embedding its roots in between the stones and into the asphalt that makes up the shingle. And to just try to kick those off or brush them off, you can actually damage your shingle more so, because it'll bring the stones along with it, leaving more of the asphalt exposed to the sun and to the elements, which will make it deteriorate all the faster. Algae is a little bit different. Similar idea, but it's not a full-on plant that's growing out of the roof, essentially. And there are a number of products out there that have lots of different claims. And each, the key there is understanding ideally which shingle you have on your roof, because the different manufacturers have different recommendations for how to treat that. I do know there's a couple different concoctions. And the interesting thing is bleach is not necessarily a bad thing when it's mixed correctly. In fact, a lot of the manufacturers specify a more specific mix that involves bleach to spray on and take care of that stuff. But the kicker with it is any of those solutions, it doesn't matter which one it is, are going to be a very temporary fix. Typically, when we do a cleaning, we see a year, or in a really good situation, maybe 2 years before it starts to come back. And so it can either be a consistent thing that has to happen every other year or so, or the shingles, depending on how old your roof actually is, it may be worth at least getting inspected to see what kind of condition it's really in. Because the shingles nowadays incorporate a lot more stones that have copper around them. And so that's mixed in with all the stones, which the copper then helps resist much more so the growth of any of that.
Yeah, I've had discussions on the show in the past about people putting copper strips along the sort of the upper side or the top end of the roof, and that the copper strips can be effective. Is that true in your experience, Josiah?
They absolutely can be effective in more so preventing than getting rid of.
Yeah.
When you're talking, copper strips are also very expensive. Yeah. And an alternative are what are called zinc strips, but the downside of those only work about 3 feet below. So in order for that to be effective, you have to install them fairly regularly throughout the roof, which isn't aesthetically pleasing, in which case you're trading one look for another. I will say the end result is the algae concept with the black streaks generally is not damaging to the shingle. It's just not always attractive.
Yeah. Yeah. Patty, does that help?
Oh, I'm sorry. I have that on my sidewalk in the driveway, because it's also in that shady tree, and it's very wet there. So the algae must be what's on my sidewalk, but what's on my shingles is actually the green growing thing.
Yeah, the moss. Yeah. So that's from the sound of it, Josiah, I probably ought to have somebody look at the roof.
Yeah, if we're looking more at the moss, again, it's in the most cases, it is better to leave it in place, because again, if you knock it off, it can bring some of the stones and granules with it. But in that case, if it's pretty substantial, then yes, it's definitely worth getting it looked at and inspected just to see what kind of damage might be in place, and really just the condition of the shingle in general.
Yeah, it's worth a look, Patty, for sure, from the sound of it. Good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Josiah Perkins, our guest today, Senior Residential Sales Manager at Security Libkey Roofing in Appleton. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here and talking about your roof today with Josiah Perkins from Security Libkey Roofing in Appleton. And you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Eugene in Viola, your turn. Hi, Eugene.
Hello, Larry. I've got an old Victorian. The roof is about three stories high, and the roof has got about 35 piece cord on it, about 35 square. Approximately. Now, the last time it was roofed about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, they took everything off, laid down flyboard, and put another roof over it. But that roof is getting a little bit bad. Now, do I take that roof off, or do I just put another roof over it? It's an asphalt roof.
Josiah, what do you think? So you've got, Eugene, if I've got this right, you have two layers of roofing, correct?
No, just one right now.
Oh, just one right now. Okay.
Plyboard down. They got the plyboard down, and they took everything off the plyboard down, and they put a roof over that.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's a super great question. That's a pretty tall roof. It can be pretty challenging to get to. But yeah, great question. We will always recommend tearing the roofs off and going all the way down to the deck. That's going to be our number one recommendation every time, regardless of the roof that's going over or going on again. If you're looking at code specifications, when it comes to living dwellings, so living space that people do live in, the code in Wisconsin does allow for up to two layers of roofing material. However, the downsides to that is most of the warranties more or less go away, and it is very difficult to flash well, because you become dependent upon the original roof's flashings around some of the detail pieces, because you are thickening up your roof. So in the instance where a roof comes into a wall, it changes the height of the roof, which changes the dynamic and the relationship between the wall and the roofing material. But the general rule is we want to know that the roof deck is good underneath and there haven't been any hidden leaks. So we are always going to recommend tearing off.
All right. Eugene, there you go. Thank you for calling. Linda in Appleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Linda.
Hi, guys. Great program again, as usual. I had the roof is 20 years old, traditional shingles. And I've had people working on my home and other parts, and they start to see some, oh, dear, what is it called? Folding or when the shingles start to deteriorate, flake.
Curling.
Whatever. Curling, that's the word. Thank you. I've heard also that there's a product that can be sprayed on to help extend the life of the shingle. What are your thoughts on that? And I'll hang up and listen, okay?
Okay.
That's another great question. I would say, in general, if your shingle's to the point of curling, then it really just needs to be replaced. I am aware of the spray-on products that supposedly revitalize. The way that works, the best way I've had that described, and I will say we don't do it, because it's just not been it's not seemed like a viable solution, and we've gotten mixed reviews when we look into that. But the idea of those products is that it's the equivalent of applying like a lotion to your skin. So as your skin is dry and cracked, similar to an asphalt shingle, especially as the stones start to fall off, more of the asphalt is exposed to the sun, and it can start to develop little tiny cracks in the asphalt. And the spray is intended to, very similar to lotion on your skin, just kind of like moisten everything back up so that those cracks, I can't say they go away, but they lessen because the material becomes re-moistened. I can't say I have an experience to say that it works, but if at a 20-year-old roof and if it's curling, that's not going to be the solution in that scenario. And then I would recommend having it looked at to more than likely get it replaced.
All right. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Greg in Green Bay emailed us. Is there any kind of roof that would be better to keep gutters clean? And what is the best method about keeping it clean?
Can you say the question again?
Is there any kind of roof that does a better job of keeping gutters clean? and then what's the best method about keeping it clean?
Sure. Okay. No, the roofing material itself really has very little to do with the cleanliness of the gutters. And depending on if you're talking a streaking kind of thing or just general buildup of debris in the gutters, a gutter protection of some sort would it be the solution for keeping debris out. But unfortunately, the roofs don't change the type of leaves and twigs and things that might be falling on the roof that would then drift down into the gutters. As far as cleaning them out, that can be done a number of different ways. If it's dry out, a leaf blower can certainly do the trick. If it's very wet, then that will not suffice very well, in which case you just have to put on some gloves and scoop it out, which then you got to factor in the safety concern because the ladders can be very precarious if they're not placed well or very solid in their footing.
Do you guys put on gutters or is it just roofs for you?
No, we do gutters. Yeah, we do gutters as well. And the gutter protection, we've got a couple varieties of the gutter protection, especially. We install seamless gutters. And then when we do that, we typically try to use larger downspouts to make sure that the water and smaller debris can just flow naturally and easily without causing any clogs at that point.
Yeah, that makes good sense. The gutter helmet type, what works best in your mind?
Well, so I've been doing this for 18 years now. And in my experience, there is no one size fits all.
Okay.
What works, your trees, the types of trees that you're dealing with will affect it. The shape of your house and the format of your house, if you have a lot of corners, not all the gutter protections will channel the water as well as others. And so it's a little more specific to the house and where the house is sitting specifically. There are a number of products that we do offer. We have one that's called Gutter Topper. That is the nose forward design, as we call it, or some refer to it as a bull nose, in which case it's a solid metal and the water kind of surface tensions back into the gutter as it comes down. It can do very, very great in certain situations, but when it doesn't, then we bring in, from the same manufacturer, a product called Leaf Terminator, which is a perforated aluminum. Very, very good product. That's the one that works on my house, I will say, and it handles the water really well and just keeps the debris not in the gutters and keeps everything free flowing. And then there are some similar alternatives that we have as well, just depending on price point and, again, the situation that the house is up against.
Yeah. Summertime, I did mention attic ventilation at the start of the show, and that is important in our last couple of minutes here. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, ventilation is extremely important, probably one of the most underlooked at features when it comes to especially roof replacement. But airflow is incredibly important, and in order to create airflow, we need good intake, which is oftentimes, at least on more recent homes, in the soffits, so just underneath the eaves, and then some kind of exhaust. And the exhaust is where there's a lot of confusion because there's a thought process that the more the merrier when it comes to the exhaust. So we put every kind of vent on the roof and hope for the best. And it just doesn't work that way. And that's another one where there is no one-size-fits-all. The up-to-date common new flashy format is the ridge vent that most are after. And it does, in so many scenarios, is this indeed the right solution, but not always. If there's not enough ridge to support the amount of attic space, then that's not always a great solution, in which case we might look at more of the traditional box vent or turtle vent, as some call them, or even a power vent, just depending what kind of attic space, how large that is that we're trying to vent, versus how much roof and ridge space we have to work with. But any airflow is better than no airflow, and what will happen without proper airflow is the shingle will essentially bake and overheat and cook from the bottom side. So it will then usually start to crack or just start to really lose its granules really quickly because the asphalt is softening up so much from the heat underneath that it just lets loose of all those stones. And so it is an extremely important part and underrated part of a roofing system.
And Josiah, on that note, boy, this half hour flew by quickly. Thank you so much. Would you be willing to come back and be with us again sometime?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah,
it was great talking with you. Josiah Perkins, Senior Residential Sales Manager at Security Libkey Roofing in Appleton, Wisconsin. They've been in business a long, long time, and obviously they know what they are doing. It's fun talking with him, and we'll get him back, and we'll do it again. Thank you so much for joining us today. This and all of our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.